So first of all, let me answer your question from last week about, like, in the mean field theory, I showed that we would that so in the mean field theory, we said something like S0 Si average value was equal to S0 Si. So this was like a mean field assumption. And then your point was, and a good one, is that, well, if that's the case, then that means that the susceptibility is zero. And yes, in this version of mean field theory, the susceptibility is zero. And I guess the point here is just that in trying to do a, you know, we're trying to solve a complicated many-body system, and we're coming up with various sorts of approximations which are not justifiable in any sort of microscopic way. So the point here is just that this particular version of mean field theory, where I make this assumption, necessarily has susceptibility equals zero. It is true that the true susceptibility has to be non-zero, so this is something that's wrong with this mean field assumption. But the point about mean field theories is that they're typically the only thing that we can actually calculate with any degree of confidence. So that's the com answer to your question. Yes.
In the homework rule, there was the assumption that the number of particles goes to infinity, and but the interaction also the span of the interaction is also to infinity. And there we proved that that the mean field theory is the exact solution for n goes to infinity, and the interaction is also.
Yes. I mean, so that's, I guess,
So
the complete graph solution.
yeah.
Yes.
So for the complete graph solution, susceptibility is also zero.
I haven't done the calculation for, no, I guess the point is that in the complete graph solution, you basically reproduce this, you know, like, so this is sort of one version of the mean field theory. Another version is where you have m equal to hyperbolic tangent of beta jm. And so the complete graph solution, limit n goes infinity, gives you this. And this has a non-zero susceptibility. So there's different versions of mean field theory. In fact, what I'm going to do today is talk about a third version of mean field theory, because the problem is that solving phase transitions is a really complicated deal, and so people have always tried to come up with these simplified versions. Okay, so what I want to do today is I want to talk about one other version of mean field theory, which is called Landau theory. Do people have a sense who Lev Landau was? Yeah, so I think it's somewhat of a generational thing. Unfortunately, he died very young. He was severely injured in a car accident in 1962 and died in 66. But he was legendary when I was a graduate student, because he was just like infinitely smart, infinitely sharp, infinitely sardonic, infinitely, you know, people were afraid of him. And he also is an amazing guy, because he survived the Stalinist purges in 1937 and 1938. He was sent to a prison where people usually get shot or sent to the gulag. But Peter Kapitsa, who was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and knew Stalin personally, said, "You've got to save this guy. This guy is going to revolutionize Soviet science." And so he survived. Anyway. But the thing is that Landau was a guy, and you know, he has this 10-volume series, like, you know, of Course in Theoretical Physics. And if you've not read any of these books, they are truly masterpieces. Anyways, so the point about Landau is that there's nothing he couldn't calculate. He was just so incredibly sharp and so smart and so technically proficient. And yet he came up with this thing called the Landau theory, for which he's probably best known now. And this Landau theory is so trivial, so simple, so obvious. Like, why didn't I think of that? And so it's just, I would like to emphasize it just because of its simplicity and because you get a lot for nothing. And typically in physics, you don't have this feature that you get a lot for nothing. Like, if you're going to do a hard calculation, you'll get a lot. If you do nothing calculation, you won't get much. But this is an example where you do a completely trivial calculation and you get a lot of bang for the buck. And so Landau's theory is based on the following assumptions. And not, these are not very serious assumptions, as you'll see. So assumptions are that for t greater than tc, the equilibrium magnetization is equal to zero. T less than TC, equilibrium magnetization, is not equal to zero. There is a phase transition. And another thing is that the free energy should be is even in the magnetization. If I stand on my head, I have the same physics as if I don't stand on my head. And so that means that when I change M to minus M, the free energy should be invariant. Or this is saying that F is equal to a function of M squared only. And finally, is that you know, F is minimum at equilibrium, which we already know from basic thermodynamics. So based on these obvious statements, let's try and write down the simplest form for the free energy that's consistent with this. And also, one other feature is that for T less than TC, the magnetization changes continuously from zero to non-zero values. So near the phase transition, the magnetization is small. If the magnetization is small, that suggests why not do some kind of a Taylor series expansion in M? And because it's an even function of M, it should be a Taylor series with only even powers of M. So putting this all together.
Sorry, why are all of these assumptions obvious? For example, the free energy is even M.
Well, so let's think about sort of an Ising model, just for the sake of argument. No magnetic field. And so that means that spin up and spin down are entirely equivalent. If two spins are pointing up, that's the same as two spins pointing down. So, yeah. So putting this all together, I'm going to write F is equal to AM squared plus BM fourth plus CM six plus dot, dot, dot. And if we're close to the critical point, higher order terms should be small because M is small. So I'm going to forget about this and higher order terms as well. So that's first point, is we'll only keep the first two terms in a Taylor expansion. Second point is that we want to have a feature that there is a phase transition, that the minimum happens at zero value above TC and a non-zero value below TC. And so Landau said the following thing, as simple can be, T minus TC M squared plus BM fourth. So A is proportional to T minus TC. So, I mean, in principle, A might have some amplitude out in front, and B might be temperature dependent. But in the for the point of view of the simplest possible description, the temperature dependence of B, like near the critical point, this is going to be perhaps smoothly varying with temperature, but it doesn't affect the critical behavior. So let me take B equals constant. And also for the point of view of simplicity, let me take the amplitude in front of the T minus TC term equal to 1. If I put a non-zero amplitude here, it just changes an overall scale and doesn't change any physics. And also here, there might be some, F zero, which is like the free energy when there's zero magnetization. And let me take that free energy to be zero. I'll choose my zero of energy such that this term is also zero. And so that's my Landau free energy. So you see that at least in terms of like technical complication, this is about as simple as you can get, but it involves these fundamental assumptions. And now let's investigate some of the basic features of this Landau free energy. So first thing, let's plot this Landau free energy as a function of M. So if T is above TC, that means that this coefficient is positive. So this is a parabola. This is a quartic curve. So this is going to be some kind of a curve which looks something like this for T larger than TC. For T less than TC, this is negative. And this dominates close to M equals zero. So it's going to go with downward curvature initially. But eventually, the fourth order term is going to win out. And so we'll get something that looks like this for T less than TC. And when T equals TC, this term goes away. And then we just have a quartic potential, which is kind of like an upside down parabola, but with a very flat bottom. And so for T, maybe I'll use another color chalk. So for T, that doesn't look very different. I don't have red, so all right. I'll have to live with this. Looks something like this. So this is our T equals TC. And so you see that as the temperature decreases to the critical temperature, you know, the magnetization has a minimum at, I mean, the free energy has a minimum at magnetization equals zero, and then these two potential wells are born and they move continuously away from M equals zero, and that corresponds to the continuous growth of the magnetization below the phase transition. So that's really, yeah.
Over there in the assumption that, for T is greater than TC, M equilibrium equals zero. How do we tell, like on this graph, like where M equilibrium is and how is that shown differently?
Well, so, I mean, hopefully for T above TC, you'll buy it that the minimum is zero. We're gonna minimize this thing with respect to M and see where the minima are, but just graphically, the minima are here in the case of T above TC and here. So this will be at plus M equilibrium and minus M equilibrium.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry, Sid.
Something else? Yeah.
For the curve that is at critical temperature, it's sort of very flat for significant values outside of zero.
Mm-hmm.
Does that correspond to some sort of, at critical temperature, is there a distribution on the magnetization that is not peaked? But
well, so, you know, now you're asking something maybe which is beyond the mean field assumption, because you might say if the free energy curve is very flat, that means that values of the magnetization away from zero are not very much different in energy. So yes, that might correspond to what you call critical fluctuations. And in fact, we'll say more about that in a little while. But again, in the mean field assumption, we're not really talking about fluctuations, which is only saying that every place has the same value of the magnetization. But that's a good point, and I'll come back to it, you know, maybe later on in this lecture. One last thing I just wanted to mention is that notice that the highest power of M here has to have a positive sign, and it has to have a positive sign so that that's for stability, because if there was a negative sign for the highest power, eventually this would go negative, and it means that you would have an infinitely, you know, you minimize the free energy by having an infinitely large magnetization. So you need that the highest power of M is positive. Okay, so let's now be a little bit more mathematical. Let's minimize the free energy. Minimize F. So we're going to just do df dm equals zero. And so even I can do this differentiation. I'm going to get 2am plus 4bm cubed is equal to zero. And so at the minimum, we have that m squared is equal to minus a over 2b. Or m equilibrium is equal to the square root of minus a over 2b. But a was t minus tc, so this is equal to the square root of tc minus t divided by 2b. And so from this, we infer that the magnetization exponent is equal to 1/2. So easy as pie, we end up with the order parameter exponent. Let's see, what else can I say? Yeah, so the other thing is that now we could say, well, suppose that there's a finite magnetic field acting on the system. And so if there's a finite magnetic field, we know that, you know, for the case of the paramagnet, we saw that the energy is proportional to minus m times h. So let's now augment this and put a minus mh, or non-zero magnetic field. And so here, minus mh. So if we minimize the free energy, so this case would be for h equals zero. So for h not equal to zero, the same procedure is going to give me zero is equal to 2am plus 4bm cubed minus m. I'm sorry, I have to differentiate with respect to m, so minus h.
I have a dumb question.
There's no dumb questions.
Shouldn't we?
Except, can I have an A in the course? Yeah.
Can I have an A?
Yeah.
So in the the equilibrium, shouldn't we have a minimum Gibbs energy, Gibbs free energy? So
well, no,
if we say at a constant temperature and constant volume, then we say that the free Hamiltonian energy should be minimum, right?
Well, so first of all, you have to decide, like, what are the thermodynamic variables? So, you know, we've learned about the Helmholtz free energy, which is a function of T and V. There's the Gibbs free energy, which is a function of T and P for a gaseous system. For a magnetic system, like, the roles of F and G are kind of interchanged. So this is actually the Helmholtz free energy in a magnetic system.
For a magnetic system, is it a solid always? Is it, what is it?
It doesn't have to be. No, I mean, it could be a liquid.
The volume is always constant, and the temperature?
Well, no, the volume is not a thermodynamic parameter in the Helmholtz free energy. The thermodynamic parameters are temperature and H.
Yeah, but my question is, if free Helmholtz energy is minimized, is the Gibbs energy also minimized?
But in the appropriate ensemble, I mean, you have to be in the right ensemble to minimize the free energy. So again, if I'm thinking about like elementary thermodynamics, you start with, say, the good old internal energy, which is minimized as a function of S and V. And the Helmholtz free energy is minimized as a function of T and V. And so you have to be in the right ensemble. So I'm telling you, I'm skipping some of these sort of fundamental details, but this is the free energy that's minimized as a function of the magnetic field and the temperature. Yes.
On the ansatz there, there's the constant B, and
there's a constant what?
The constant B.
Yes.
Shouldn't it be like at least a second power of the temperature, just by the units we have here? Shouldn't it have the same units as the first term?
Very good point. Yes, absolutely. If A is of units of temperature, then this should units of temperature squared. Absolutely. So from the point of view of dimensionally correct and dimensional analysis plays such a useful role in physics. This should be like a T squared. But all I'm trying to argue here is that it's a analytic function at near TC. So it'll be just some constant value with some slow variation that I don't care about.
I ask because that might affect the derivation of beta being 1/2. For example,
no,
TC minus T squared.
But that's a singular function near TC. What I would argue here is that this B would be equal to a B0 plus a B1 T squared, where B0 has units of temperature squared. And so this, as T goes to TC, is just some slowly varying function which doesn't affect anything. So again, if you really want to have like the exact answer, you know, then you have to worry about all these details. But if you only want the asymptotic answer, then you can throw things away. And, you know, again, one of these things that I think is a very important lesson for graduate students to learn is like what you can throw away and what you can keep. You know, when I was your age, I was always like calculate everything exactly, and then you learn that like you can do a lot of pain and work really hard and find out that you've wasted a lot of it for nothing because you don't learn anything new from it. Okay, anyway, so this is for H equals zero, not equal to zero, we get this. And so notice that at T equals TC, well, by construction, the A term is equal to zero. And so from this, we get H is equal to 4bm cubed. And from this, we have that m is proportional to H to the 1/3. So we've now inferred the other critical exponent, delta 1/3. So you see, like, I'm not working very hard to derive some very non-trivial results. If T is not equal to TC, or T not equal to TC, well, then we have, you know, 0 is equal to 2am plus 4bm cubed, or let's write it this way, H is equal to this. Okay. So let me maybe put this over. Oh, I guess I can put this up here.
Can you once again say why you just enter the magnetization field H?
Why I what?
Why you enter H as only the coefficient of M to want, like, not to want.
Well, okay, because the thing is that this is a free energy, and the free energy is the sum of the total energy plus the entropy term. And when I turn on a finite magnetic field, we saw that in the case of, I mean, the definition of a spin system is that how it responds to a magnetic field, which is just M times H. So it's just like the true energy of a spin, whether it's aligned with the field or anti-aligned with the field.
Have other terms like M2H or, I don't know.
M squared H? Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, again, if I start with quantum mechanics and say, like, what is the energy of a spin in a magnetic field, you'll find that it's proportional to the magnetization times the magnetic field. And also in elementary electrostatics or magnetostatics, you also learn that a magnetic moment, its energy in a magnetic field is minus M times H. So it comes from electrostatics. It's probably the simplest answer. Okay. So why am I fumbling here?
Can I again ask, how did you safely assume that B is not temperature dependent?
Is not temperature dependent? No, I'm saying that it could be temperature dependent, but it's just a very smooth function of temperature through the critical point. So again, if you want to include that temperature dependence, feel free to do so, but then you'll find that after you do a lot of work, you know, like, where is my magnetization? Like over here, if B is like B0 plus something T squared, that's not going to affect the critical exponent. So if I'm only interested in critical exponents, then I don't have to worry about all these details. Okay. Anyway, so coming back to here, the point I just want to make is that A is proportional to T minus TC. M cubed is proportional to T minus TC cubed. I can't remember, so excuse me. I was hoping not to look at my notes, but I'm blanking out here. H. Oh yeah, I'm making it much harder than I need to. Okay, so from that equation, let's look at dH dm, which is equal to 2a plus 12 dm squared. And so what is this? Wait a second. Okay, so again, here's two. There's two cases to consider. One is T larger than TC.
Did we assume that in the dHdm that T is constant?
Yes. I'm doing this. This is like partial derivative dHdm. So, well, it's the inverse susceptibility.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So that's what I'm trying to calculate. For T larger than TC, the magnetization is zero. So that we get dHdm is equal to 2a, or dmdh is equal to 1 over 2a, which is proportional to 1 over t minus tc. And so from this, we infer that the susceptibility exponent gamma is equal to 1. If t is less than tc, then we have to work a smidgen harder. So dmdh, but m squared. So where was my m squared? It's minus a over 2b. So I'm going to have the dHdm is equal to 2a plus 12b. And then m squared, I said, was minus a over 2b. And so this is equal to a over 2b squared. A over 2b, that's right. Yeah, OK. So this is, so the b's cancel, the 2 makes a 6, the a, so this is equal to minus 4a. minus, what am I doing wrong here? Yeah, this, sorry. What's going on? Yeah, no, this, sorry. My dyslexia is hitting me hard here. So I have dhdm, this is dm dh 1 over 2a, we're done. Okay, here, dhdm 2a, okay, so this is equal to minus 4a. And so from this, we get that dm dh, which is again the susceptibility, is equal to minus 1 over 4a. And for t less than tc, this is perfectly fine and diverges at tc. And again, we see that on both sides of the phase transition, we have gamma equals 1. So with very little work, we've derived all the exponents of the mean field theory.
So for the case of t greater than tc, we assume that m is equal to 0, right?
We don't assume. That's what comes out.
No,
yes.
But it was the Landau assumption.
Well, no, so the Landau, but I mean, in some sense, it's not even an assumption. I mean, it's like that's the observed experimental fact that there's no magnetization above tc. That's the definition of being above tc. So maybe that's even a little strong call it an assumption. It's a fact.
Yeah. So what is weird to me is that if we assume that m is equal to 0 for t greater than tc without writing the whole function, we couldn't have taken the derivative and see that dhdm is equal to 2a. We would have had just h is equal to 0 for t greater than tc. Why is that wrong? Why is saying h is 0 for t greater than tc?
No, but h is an external magnetic field that I, as an experimentalist, am free to either turn on or turn off as I want, as I choose.
M is 0 for t greater than tc, and say dm dh is equal to 0.
Well, I mean, two things. I mean, one is that, you know, I am making assumption that the free energy is some kind of an analytic function of analytic and continuous function of m and h. So I'm free to then differentiate with respect to h.
I'm struggling to understand the physical meaning here, because if we have an external field called h, and that a dm dh is proportional to inverse of the temperature, so m cannot stay zero, right?
Ask your question again. I'm not sure I'm getting it.
Dm dh, so if you change the magnetic field,
yes,
you're getting a non-zero m.
No, but it's the other way around. Your control parameter, the knob that you have in the lab, is the magnetic field. And then the response is the magnetization. So, I mean, in terms of physics, the interesting thing is not dhdm, it's dm by dh. But in terms of mathematics, once I write the free energy as a function of m and h, then I'm perfectly free to, like, play around with the calculus.
Okay.
Let other people ask questions, because you start. Yeah.
I'm confused about in our t greater than tc case, why b is 0.
Why what to 0?
Taking b to 0.
M is 0.
So
no, m is 0.
M to 0, we're assuming that second term goes away before we can even reverse the derivative.
No, but the thing is, I mean, this is certainly mathematically a true statement. You know, I'm talking about that I have the free energy as a function of h and m. I'm minimizing it, so at the minimum free energy, I have a relation between the magnetic field and the magnetization.
I think my confusion is actually the same as Ali's, in that I don't know when we're taking m to be zero. I'm confused about the timing of when we can take m to be zero here.
I'm doing it. So the thing is that, as written, this is a true statement in general. No matter where I am, whether I'm above TC, below TC. But the thing is that above TC, the magnetization is equal to 0. So this result has two possibilities, depending on whether you're above TC, in which case this holds, or below TC, in which case that holds. Does that help?
Sorry. I think the confusion might be that those assumptions are for zero field, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
When you're above TC, the magnetization is 0 at 0, but then the magnetization isn't 0 anymore.
Okay.
It
would be
true?
A back reaction. You have dm dh non-zero, so you would have a non-zero m squared there. So that would also affect your dm dh. So I think if you want to calculate that at equilibrium, you have to take, maybe we get the same answer. I don't know. But,
mm-hmm. But you see, the thing is that, I mean, your comment, I mean, that's a well-taken point, but it's just that notice here that when I compute dh by dm, it doesn't involve h. So it's true for both h not equal to 0 and h equals 0. Yes?
I think I'm confused about this as well, because when we differentiate dm by dh, and then we substitute m squared equals minus a over 2b.
Right.
But that's only true
at 0 magnetic field.
Zero.
That's right. That's correct. So I'm you know, I'm mostly interested in the zero field susceptibility, because that's in some sense where the system is most ticklish. And so I care only about zero magnetic field susceptibility.
So we're studying the change in H when H is zero.
Yes. All right. I'm sorry that this was so unclear. I hope that, I hope you see that, like, the amount of mathematical detail that's involved here is kind of nothing. And so, you know, just come at me, like, in office hours with more with detailed questions. Yes?
I think it makes sense now.
Okay.
Because what you're doing is basically, you could write it as dmdh is equal to 1 over 2a plus 12 bm squared. But if you're just interested to whether the system is more ticklish, so that would be n equals 0. So that's
yes.
where you're studying.
H equals 0, you mean?
Yes. What did I say?
You said m equals 0.
H is equal to 0.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay, so that's the end of my discussion of the Landau theory. And I just want to mention more as like almost a zoology lesson, just there's something called the Landau-Ginzburg approach. Just so you at least see these words and see something. Can you read this, or is that too?
It's kind of hard to read.
Sorry to read.
I don't know what it is. There's certain parts of the blackboard that just seem like the talk doesn't adhere to it. Landau. And the word theory should be like taken with a grain of salt, because the Landau-Ginzburg approach is, again, kind of very Landauian in the sense that you just make a bunch of assumptions and try and ask, like, what is the simplest consequences of these assumptions. And this is the so-called Landau-Ginzburg theory. And this is an attempt to try and include the effect of fluctuations. So in the good old Landau theory, there's only like an average magnetization. Every spin is the same as every other spin. Everybody has the same average magnetization. But in reality, we know that there is domain walls. There's regions of positive magnetization, regions of negative magnetization. How do we incorporate that in the framework of a simple-minded theory? And so the Landau-Ginzburg theory is a natural generalization of the Landau theory, in which we assume that the magnetization is a function of spatial location. So now, instead of having a function, this one, you have a function of many points in space, is what's called a functional. Maybe you've heard that terminology before. And so the Ginzburg-Landau free energy is just a spatial integral over all space of the local magnetization field throughout all space. And it's the same as before. So it's going to be, we're going to have A M of R squared plus B M of R fourth plus higher order terms. So everything is the same as before, but we're allowing the possibility that the magnetization can vary as a function of space. And so we want to integrate over the magnetization density to get the total free energy. And now there's one new feature, which is crucial. And it's the idea that, well, if there are gradients of the magnetization, the system doesn't like gradients. Because if you're below the phase transition, you'd like to have the magnetization being all one value. So one introduces a cost for having some kind of having gradients in the magnetization. And again, it's like there's not a microscopic way to derive this. This is only phenomenological. And what we just do this. Gradient m absolute value squared plus higher order terms in gradients. So the point here is that if there's up-down symmetry, if I'm thinking about like a Ising-like spin system, then if there is a gradient in the magnetization, it can't depend on the sign of the gradient. So having positive gradients or negative gradients have the same energy cost. So this thing is called the Landau-Ginzburg free energy functional. And as I say, there's no microscopic way to derive this theory, but this is, turns out to be one of the most successful theory of phase transitions and understanding its dynamics. So far, we've only been talking about equilibrium statistical physics, but this is a way of trying to introduce dynamics into the system. And the way that one completes this story here is saying, well, if I want to say, well, how does, you see here, there's sort of a, there's a competition going on, because if there's gradients, you know, that's an energy cost. But gradients mean that the magnetization can't be the same everywhere. And if the magnetization is not the same everywhere, that means that the magnetization cannot always be equal at the equilibrium value. So there's a tension between this term, which tries to force the magnetization to be everywhere the same and at the equilibrium value, and this term, which, you know, is allowing for the possibility that gradients actually exist. And so sometimes people write this, all of this stuff is just V of M. And so now to get an equation of motion out of this, one says, well, how does the free energy change dF by dt? And so this is a pure assumption and only an assumption, which is that, it is minus delta F delta M of R. So this delta here means functional derivative. And it's, you know, functional derivative sounds so fancy schmancy, but all it really is, it's just the derivative at each point in space. And so this is a pure assumption. And so this is what's called gradient descent, in the sense that the free energy, whenever there's a gradient in the it follows the gradient of the free energy with respect to the magnetization. So wherever there's a, whenever like in a large high dimensional state space, there's the free energy surface. And I'm trying to just go at places where the free energy is decreasing the fastest. That tells me how the free energy changes. And so if you do this function.
Should that also have a dmdt?
Pardon me?
Should that also have a dmdt on the right hand side?
Dmdt.
Dfdt is minus delta. I don't understand the dimensionality of that. Because if dfdt is dimension, the dimension of free energy, and then t is time,
yep,
the right hand side should have the same dimensions.
Okay, well, you're absolutely correct in the sense that dimensionally, this is kind of a little bit fuzzy. So what would I say here is that, you know, if I want to be careful with dimensions, then in some sense, this I could think of as like some appropriate non-dimensionalized magnetization. So oftentimes in physical problems, like something like this, what I've swept under the rug is that I've non-dimensionalized things, so everything is dimensionless. Like the classic example of this is, say, like the Navier-Stokes equation for fluid mechanics. You know, so you have like dV dt is something, there's a pressure term, there's a gradient, there's viscosity, there's all these things in it. And if you write things in appropriate dimensionless units, you can make the entire equation dimensionless, and there's one parameter, which is the Reynolds number. So I've been a little bit sloppy here because there's no dimensions in this, but I'm saying let's just think about the non-dimensionalized thing and worry about the dimensions of this later. Yes?
To that question, if we were to make the dimensions work out by putting a constant in front of the derivative, functional derivative, mm-hmm, then that would be a parameter of the theory.
That's right. But I mean, in some sense, if I put a parameter here such that I make this the whole units of time, that's effectively like rescaling the time by some constant factor. It doesn't change anything. Yes?
Sorry, I'm a little confused. Why does dF dt equal delta F delta?
This is purely an assumption. It's like you ask, why is that? And I'm just saying a most reasonable assumption is that if you have, you know, again, in some high dimensional state space, there's a free energy surface. And the assumption is that when the system is trying to go to equilibrium, it's going to try and minimize the free energy as quickly as possible by going down the gradient. And so this formula is called gradient descent, and that's what comes out of it.
But then I've also got another question. You mentioned that the VM term is trying to keep all the magnetizations the same, but I don't quite see why.
The BM term? No, BM, the BM,
no,
you mean?
VM, like that whole.
Oh, gradient M, gradient.
No, you said you.
The potential term, something like that?
This V of M.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's just that this is just a definition, just am squared plus bm fourth. I'll define that thing to be v.
So you said something about like that whole term. That term kind of wants all of the m's to be the same. But
right. Because the thing is that this term, this is minimized when m is equal to m equilibrium.
Oh, okay.
And all, and that means that m everywhere is equal to m equilibrium. Okay. So I just have one more thing I want to say about this. So let's do this functional derivative. And again, if you're not used to it, it's no big deal. But the point here is that when I differentiate, and you maybe if you remember from classical mechanics, you know, you have a Lagrangian function as a function of Q and Q dot, and you want to minimize it with respect to Q. And here we have M, but it's actually gradient of M. And so in order to make this M itself, we can write this as grad M times grad M. And then we do a partial integration. And so grad M times grad M, you do integration by parts in one of the terms, and it'll be a term which is M, Laplacian of M, and then an integrated term which vanishes. And so now I can do the functional derivative with respect to M gradient of M squared. And what comes out of all of this is Laplacian of M. And then here, plus V prime of M is equal to df by dt. And so this thing is called the time-dependent Ginzburg-Landau equation, time dependent Ginzburg-Landau equation. And it turns out to be one of the most useful equations of mathematical physics, because lots of people have essentially, you take this equation, plug it on a computer and just watch it evolve. And so you'll see all kinds of beautiful patterns of how magnetization evolves as a function of time. I'll have much more to say about this maybe one or two lectures from now. We're going to talk about the time-dependent Ising model. But I mean, this is more just for cultural information, just the fact that there is this Landau-Ginzburg theory, Ginzburg-Landau theory. Yes?
The V prime, is the prime a derivative with respect to M?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
What the sign, there should be minus.
Is there what? Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so I think that's all I want to say for this now.
When you did the partial, the integration by parts,
yes,
you throw out the boundary term.
That's right.
It's not obvious to me why you can do that.
Well, because I'm just saying that if I have a finite sample and it's and I integrate out to infinity, there'll be nothing at infinity, so there's no magnetization.
If, for example, we're at one of the equilibrium magnetization values.
Yeah, but again, all these integrated terms always vanish at infinity because there's nothing at infinity.
Okay.
So this is, you know, we're imagining we're integrating over all space. And these integrated, you know, this happens all the time when you're doing like this sort of thing in electrostatics. There's nothing at infinity, so you don't have to worry about it. Okay, so let's see.
Can you just quickly say, how did you exactly write the Landau-Ginzburg integral?
How did I what?
How did I write this integral?
Assumption. This is purely assumption. The same way that Landau's free energy was an assumption. So Ginzburg said, well, you know, like we have a time a spatially varying magnetization. What's the simplest form that's consistent with the symmetries of the system and, you know, and physical intuition? So that's basically it. That's how he wrote it. And by the way, he won a Nobel Prize. So, you know, it's not like this is like something obvious that you can do. All right, so I'm almost done with my discussion of mean field theory. And the last thing I want to mention, and then we can take a quick break, is I want to talk about the so-called Ginzburg criterion. And so question, when is mean field theory valid? That's a basic question. You know, I've spent some time now deriving mean field theory. And you might say, so when does this actually work? And this is answered by something called the Ginzburg criterion. And it's an important development because it tells us how the dimension of space enters in a fundamental way in quantifying phase transition. And so the idea of the Ginzburg criterion is the following. Suppose I have a magnetic system, I'm above TC, and then I'm lowering the temperature closer and closer to the critical point. You have some sort of sense that as you get closer to the critical point, there ought to be fluctuations because there's regions that are become almost ready to magnetize and some regions that aren't magnetized. And if I go below the phase transition, there'll be a non-zero magnetization. But if the temperature is just below TC, some regions might be better magnetized than some other regions. And so the idea of the Ginzburg criterion is that mean field theory is valid if the fluctuations in the magnetizations, the variance in the magnetization squared, in some sense, is much, much less than the average magnetization itself. That's the Ginzburg criterion. I've swept something under the rug here, which is that what do I mean by the fluctuations of the magnetization? So what I mean is the deviation of the magnetization from its average value averaged over some region of space. And what region of space should I average this over? And I argue that the region of space I should average over is a region where spins actually are correlated. So as I'm near the phase transition, there is long-range correlations, and so it's only over the region where spins are correlated that this should hold. So here, let me write this as correlation length to the power d. Well, I don't need the brackets here. So this is like my correlation volume. And similarly to this, over the correlation volume. So C is the correlation length. The correlation length of power D is a volume of space over which, you know, the interactions are such that information can get transmitted. And so I want to compute this average, you know, over this correlation volume. Okay, so let's do this. So what is the definition of the variance in the magnetization? So this is nothing more than summation over all I, SI minus SI average. And then I have to square all of this stuff. And this, so I can write this as a summation ij. So I'll have si minus si average, sj minus sj average, because it's, let me make this a little bit neater, sj average. Because, you know, I'm taking this something squared, summing something and squaring it. So I have two independent summations, and that's a minus sign. And so what is this? So there's average here, average out here. So I'm taking the average value of the deviation of the magnetization from its average value. And so if you look at all of this, summation ij, and then I'll have si sj, that's the first term, minus, and then here I have si average sj, and then I average that, so I'll get si average sj average, and then I have another term, si sj average average, so that's another si sj average. There's two such terms with a minus sign. And then the last term is SI average, SJ average, average, which is nothing more than SI average, SJ average with a plus sign. This minus SI average, SJ average. And now if I just imagine fixing I and summing over all J, and this is sort of over my correlation volume, that's exactly the susceptibility as I defined it before. And then I have one more summation. And so this is nothing more than the susceptibility times the correlation volume. So that's the left-hand side of the equation. And the right-hand side of the equation is summation over all I, SI.
Times KT.
Yeah, but I'm not worrying about KT. Yeah. Of course, okay. You should go to law school, too. Yes?
There, you implicitly assume that the susceptibility is an extensive quantity.
No, no, I derived last time, you know, for a spin system that this quantity was the volume of the system times the susceptibility. Remember that I did the, you know, for the Ising model, I showed that, like, you know, when you computed the M by the H, that it was equal to exactly this. Anyway, so so this is the left hand side. This is the right hand side.
Why are we taking the variance if it was like average before? Is that a variance?
So I want to compute the average value, that sort of the average of the fluctuations in a
variance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so what is this? Well, this is nothing more than, you know, if I'm summing over this correlation volume. So this is nothing more than the magnetization times the volume squared. So this is just M squared times the correlation volume squared. So I have that my criterion is chi much, much less than M squared correlation volume. I'm sorry, 2D to the power D. But this is nothing more than, and allow me to write little t for t minus tc so I don't have extra junk in my formula. This is t to the minus gamma, much, much less than t to the power 2 beta minus d nu. And in order for this to be much less than this, or maybe let's write it another way, we can write that 1 should be much, much less than t to the gamma plus 2 beta minus d nu.
Sorry, what happened to the second to last line? Where did t come from?
T is t minus tc.
Ah.
Chi, you know, this guy goes as t minus tc to the power minus gamma. And then I'm writing t minus tc is little t just to have less crap.
Sorry, why is chi much, much less than m squared?
Well, that was the Ginsburg criterion, that the fluctuations should be small compared to the mean square average. Okay. Anyway, so yes.
Is xi to the power d t to the power minus t nu?
Say again?
Is xi to the power d equal to somehow t to the power minus t?
Yeah, so this is the correlation length, which goes as t minus tc to the power minus nu. So I'm, you know, chi was equal to t minus tc to the power minus gamma, and the magnetization was equal to tc minus t to the power plus beta. Those were the critical exponents. Okay, anyway, so if I plug this all in here, and now the reason I'm stumbling is that something looks upside down to me, because in order for this to, for this to be much larger than 1, this exponent better be negative. If it's a positive exponent, as t goes to tc, t to like a positive exponent will go to 0, which violates this. So in order for this to be true, we must have that this exponent is negative, which is that d must be larger than gamma plus 2 beta over nu. That is the Ginsburg criterion. So it tells us the range of space, spatial dimension, in which fluctuation for 5 minutes. So if you want to run out or not, please do, and then we'll reconvene in 5 minutes.
You said for d equated for your fluctuations are negligible.
Correct.
But as you said, we live in a space.
Right. So fluctuations do play an important role in three dimensions.
So the
calculation of critical exponents in three dimensions was one of the hallmarks of Wilson's theory.
So these are all spatial dimensions.
What?
These are all spatial dimensions.
Yes. Yes.
Sure. Could you re-explain how you set A equals T minus TC in at the beginning of lecture in F? Intuition?
Well, no. So the only point here is that I know that above TC there's no magnetization. Below TC there is a non-zero magnetization. That's an experimental fact. So I must have that my free energy has this sort of like upside down parabola shape that develops two other additional minima. And so the question is like, what is the simplest mathematical form of a power series expansion that allows for the possibility that there is this switch in behavior in the magnetization as a function of magnetization. So A should change sign as I go through TC.
Okay.
That's first. That's the, even the more basic point, the fact that A changes sign. And the thing is that once A changes sign, then you can say, well, it's somehow a function of T minus TC. What's the simplest function of T minus TC? Linear function.
If you started with, let's say, T minus TC cubed, and then what you got, what you would have gotten here would have been that your gamma would have been...
Yes, then you get a, like a whole different family of exponents.
And then you would have probably had fluctuations are negligible for greater dimensions.
That's correct. And so, in fact, if you do something like that, this is like, you know, there are different types of models that don't have necessarily up-down symmetry, for which you can have different powers of A, of different powers having different critical, different dependences on temperature. So in fact, like for example, for the Potts model, which is another type of spin system, maybe you've heard the term or maybe you haven't, but in that case, there is a cubic term that's admitted in the Landau free energy, and so you end up getting like the sixth critical dimension of that model. So yes, I mean, you, if you did like A not proportional to T minus TC, but some other power of T minus TC, that would correspond to a different type of critical behavior. But again, if we just want to look at the simplest possibility, just linear is the simplest possibility. Yes?
Have we derived that correlation length, the power of the correlation length?
No, I okay. you're right. I have not. I have not derived the correlation length. So please take it as an assumption that the correlation length diverges as 1 over T minus TC to the power nu, where nu is equal to 1/2 in the mean field theory. Yes?
I have a quick question. The T here is time, but here T, the little t.
Oh, yeah, I see. Okay, so this is just T minus TC. It's just because I'm being lazy.
Here is time,
correct, yes.
And also, confusion about the calculation exponent. Like, we're finding that it should be d less than that from this.
Tell me.
Gamma plus 2 beta minus d nu should be greater than 0, which means if you add.
No. This should be less than 0.
Why should.
The thing is, T minus TC is going to 0. So in order for this to be larger than 1, this has to blow up. And so to blow up, this exponent has to be negative.
I'm also a little bit still confused about, it seems like we're going in circles and saying we're using mean field theory to say mean field theory works. Is there a way around that, or is this just thinking about?
Well, why do you say, I'm not sure I understand why you say it's circular.
I feel like we're, to calculate these, like this whole mentality has been, we're assuming mean field theory.
Right.
And now we're showing it works because we're assuming mean field theory.
No, but I'm showing like where it doesn't work. You know, let's assume the mean field theory. There's no, you know, fluctuations are small, the free energy has this expansion. So we'd build this whole apparatus. And I'm saying, whoops, here's where mean field theory will not work.
So if we take into account all the assumptions, then
right.
This is where these assumptions don't work. We're not showing,
that's right.
Showing where it doesn't work.
Exactly so. Yes.
So you said that the simplest model, which is T minus TC, well, that's fair.
Yes.
And you showed that for D greater than 4, it doesn't work.
Yes, less than 4.
Yeah, less than 4, sorry.
Yes.
Less than 4, I can't work.
Yes.
But you could have fit a T minus TC cubed, and it's not as simple, but it's still pretty simple. And then you could have just said, oh, well.
Yeah, then there'll be a different upper critical dimension in that case.
And then you would have said, okay, the fluctuations are negligible, we win, and we don't need to study anything further.
Yeah, but why? I mean, but then you're going to have to justify why did you put T minus TC cubed as the A term.
So, but now you should justify why you put T minus TC, and you're just saying it's Occam's razor.
No. I'm just saying that it's the simplest function, which, you know, we have a function which vanishes at T minus TC and changes sign. So the question is, if you have a function that, so this I'm plotting as a function of T minus TC, I have some function that goes through 0 and changes sign. And I ask you, like, what's the simplest thing you could draw?
Minus TC, but
yeah. I mean, the thing is, T minus TC cubed means you got to do something really, you know, funky here. So that doesn't seem very simple.
Yes. That E term under V of M, is that the whole integral or is that just the integrand?
That's just the thing inside the square brackets. So V of M is A, you know, this is A M of R.
Also functional.
Say it again? Yeah, V is also functional. Yes.
So how are you, is that V prime of M there? Is that a derivative?
Functional derivative again. Yes. I mean, since we're not going to use it, that's why I'm not really, you know, belaboring the point. But I'm just so that you've seen it, so that if you see it again at some point, just say, oh, yeah, I saw this already once before. It's not completely foreign to me.
Also, how did the integral go away when you do the, like?
Because I'm doing this with respect to a particular magnetization at a particular point.
A particular point.
Right. That's why it's functional derivative. And that's why the integral goes away. Okay, so I think I'm going to start again. And what am I doing now? Where are my notes? Oh, yes, okay. So now we're going to do a very big switch in our... how do I get this to... Why does it do this? There we go. Oops. We're going to do a very big switch in perspective because I want to spend a little bit of time now talking about the renormalization group approach. So when I was discussing with people at the Perimeter Institute about teaching this class in statistical physics, they said, oh, yes, we want you to spend a month on the renormalization group and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, you know, I don't think this is serving the students well, actually, because as you're going to see, the renormalization group is an incredibly beautiful and powerful way of thinking about phase transitions. But all the technical details are just horrible technical details that don't really teach you very much. So I'm going to try and present to you the renormalization group in absolutely the simplest way I can think of. And that involves the percolation problem. So let me introduce to you now, forgetting, so this is a preliminary, the percolation problem. And in fact, maybe I'm going to do this over here because I want to ask for the screen to come down, please. I have pictures to show. Thank you. Thank you. Well, hopefully something is going to show up here. You cannot share because this chair is not allowed. Will my screen show? Oh, something's happening. Okay, there we go. Percolation. So I guess I put it over here. So percolation is a purely geometrical problem. Imagine you have a square lattice, and at each side of the square lattice, you put down a coin. And if you have two coins that are nearest neighbor, you say they are part of a cluster that contains two sites. And the question is, what is the geometry of this percolation problem as a function of the freak density of coins that you put down? So it turns out that there's two, whoops, I didn't mean to do that. So here, for example, is a square lattice when the density of coins is 0.2. And you see that there's some. Here's a trimer, three of them in a row. But most of the clusters are isolated. And so for P less than PC, we have isolated clusters. On the other hand, if we go to P much above PC, which turns out for the square lattice is 0.593 dot, 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 so here's 0.8, and you see that in this particular case, everything is more or less connected. There is little regions of isolated, of sort of little islands here. But basically, everything is connected into one huge cluster. So for P large, greater than PC, you know, there's global connectivity. Global connectivity. And the way that we quantify, yeah, go ahead.
Could you say the setup one more time?
So I have a square lattice, and I put coins at each side of the square lattice with probability P, which I am, as the user, I'm free to choose. And so when P is small, then my coins will make little isolated clusters. When P is like around 0.8, then the clusters make this huge percolating cluster that gets all the way across the lattice.
When do we connect them?
What do you mean, when do we connect them?
Is that part of the game, or?
Yeah, the game is that anything which is nearest neighbor, I say I consider as part of a connected cluster. So the thing is that another way we can characterize these isolated clusters is by the typical cluster size, C. And this turns out to go as P minus PC to the power nu. So just as we saw in a thermal phase transition in percolation, the cluster size or the correlation length is growing like P minus PC to the power nu. For P larger than PC, there's global connectivity. Here, this sample is so small that we don't even see any little isolated finite clusters. But if we only look at the size of finite clusters, the size of finite clusters is going to zero as P approaches one, because everything is swallowed up by the macroscopic cluster. So this behavior is actually true both above and below the critical point, where this refers to the size of finite clusters. So below PC, all clusters are finite by definition. Above PC, there's one so-called infinite cluster, if I had an infinite sample, and everything else constitutes the finite clusters, and they have this divergence as P approaches PC. However, right at PC, which is 0.593, you have something that looks like this. You see that here is a cluster that sort of is only this little region here, but there's this cluster of open circles that gets from one end of the sample the other end. So this is like what would be the analog of an infinite cluster in an infinite system. And in the case of percolation, this is what's called the incipient infinite cluster. And the word incipient means that at P equals PC, there is like this incipient infinite cluster. And the way that we quantify this is by something called the percolation probability. The probability that a randomly chosen site belongs to this incipient infinite cluster. And this thing goes as PC minus P to the power beta. This is the exact analog of the magnetization. Can you guys see this here? Or is this thing blocking the way? Sorry. Whoops. I want this one to raise. Can you see that now? Okay, good. Okay, so this thing is like, this is sort of like the analog of the magnetization. The correlation length is correlation length. And so that's the basic phenomenology of percolation. This transition between no connectivity and connectivity as the probability that a site is occupied by a coin goes through this critical value 0.59. Yes?
So what's that P of P?
So this thing is, sorry, I guess I said it, but I didn't write it down. This is what's called a percolation probability.
Is that the same P as the probabilities there?
This what?
That piece is the same piece?
No, P is the density of occupied sites.
So
little p here, this is the density of occupied sites, or occupation densities. Somebody else?
Yeah, would you mind also repeating what you said before? I didn't quite catch it. Why are we relating isolated clusters and global connectivity to P minus PC to the minus nu?
Nu. Yeah, so what I'm saying is that if I focus attention only on the finite clusters, the average size of finite clusters has this divergence both above and below PC. Below PC, all clusters are finite by definition, because there's nothing percolating. And as they approach a percolation threshold, the typical size of these finite clusters grows without bound. On the other hand, way above the critical point, there's this one infinite cluster that swallows up everything, and there's just a few isolated finite clusters. And as they approach the critical percolation point from above, the size of these remaining finite clusters also grows and diverges at PC. I mean, that's actually kind of a subtle feature, but that's the phenomenology. Yes?
Can you say again how we are measuring the size of a cluster?
You know, I put my ruler here and say, well, this is that big. That's really, you could do caliper distances as a measure of the size. You know, any, you know, the thing is that, again, in the point of view, from the point of view of critical phenomenon, it doesn't matter do you do caliper distance or the radial distance, all these distances are all scaling the same way. And so just whatever is convenient. Okay. Yeah.
I thought the probability is a parameter that you set, like you change it or like.
That's right. The probability P is like the temperature T in the magnetic system. I am free to choose it. I'm asking as a function of this occupation probability, how do these critical quantities change as a function of P? And they all show this transition at 0.59.
But you said the probability is a function of the density.
Right.
The density.
This is capital P. That has nothing, that's different than little p.
The density is the probability. Okay.
Okay. All right. So now let me try and pictorially give you a feeling for like what the renormalization group is all about. Because as we're going to see, or like I'm going to try, what I want to try and do is show you the absolute simplest way to calculate a renormalization group transformation and to compute critical exponents in the absolute simplest way, because, you know, everything else is just technical details that is not terribly illuminating. Yes?
What does it mean when percolation probability is u at p equal to pc?
That means that. Okay, so this starts getting a little bit subtle, but the point is that if I go just below the critical point, there's only finite clusters. And when the first infinite cluster appears, it's very stringy and very ramified and actually occupies zero density of the entire lattice. Whereas as soon as you go above PC, this infinite cluster actually occupies a finite fraction. So that's why I plot, you know, the percolation probability as a function of P. So, you know, here is PC. It's zero below PC and then rises in the same way that the magnetization rises. So at the critical point, the magnetization, you know, infinitesimally below the critical point in the magnetic system, magnetization is non-zero. But where the magnetization, you know, exists spatially is a very ramified structure.
P itself is also less than 1.
P is 0.59 at the critical point.
P and PC, but then if P is greater than PC, PC minus P is something less than minus.
Oh, sorry. That's my mistake. Sorry. And this is true only for P larger than PC, because for P less than PC, there's nothing. So this is the percolation probability, and so it looks like the magnetization. It's entirely analogous to the magnetization. Okay, so next slide. So here is a larger system above PC. And the idea is the following, is that if I imagine rescaling, maybe you've heard that term, rescaling the system. I'm going to rescale the system and ask what happens when I rescale. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to change my length scale by a factor of 2. So I'm going to zoom out by a factor of 2. So I zoom out by a factor of 2. I do this. But then so now you see that if I sort of squint, like the probability P, the density of this rescaled system is going to look a little bit different than what we started with. So if I go backwards, you know, here's the value P above PC. It's kind of looking a little bit more homogeneous. So to make this a little bit more clear, I'm going to sort of take 3 more copies of this and put it together. And the crucial point here is that there's now a different P, a different effective density at this rescaled level. There'll be some function of the starting point and some function of the length scale transformation. And so if I do the same thing again, so I rescale by a factor of 2, so I'm going to get another probability. And you see as I continue rescaling, the system is looking more and more homogeneous, and it's actually being driven towards P equals 1. So I just do this over and over again. This is what's called a renormalization group transformation. It's a transformation of the value of the density as a function of the length scale. And you see, by the time I get to like 6 levels of this renormalization, my system is looking pretty homogeneous. It's actually been driven towards P equals 1. So the crucial point here is that for P above PC, this rescaling transformation drives the density towards P equals 1. For P less than PC, if I did the same kind of thing, you would see that the density would be driven to 0 because you have little isolated clusters. The size of the coins would get smaller. The picture would look whiter and whiter as you continue to renormalize. And renormalize towards P equals 0. It's only at PC that the transformation is at a fixed point in the sense that the system will look self-similar at all length scales. You have a question.
When you do this rescaling, are you also reducing the resolution or not?
Am I doing the what?
The resolution. Because like if you don't reduce resolution, there are still some points like these clusters are not connected yet. And
well, so
it's exactly the same problem as before.
No. So the thing is that when I'm doing so what I'm doing is that you know I'm squishing the system down, but I'm keeping my lattice that I'm sort of measuring the same scale.
So the resolution is fixed.
Yes.
Okay. It means that you're reducing resolution.
Right. Yes. So it's like you're squinting and getting more and more nearsighted as you're going along. You're asking, what does the system look like as you get progressively more nearsighted? And so in this particular case, you're being driven to P equals 1.
So your four corners of your squares are not exactly the same thing that they were before rescaling? Because if they are...
What do you mean the four corners are not?
Because as you said... nearest neighbors are the ones that are on the same squares, the corners of the same square.
Yes.
So if that's the case, it doesn't matter how small you make this or how big you make this. If you go into that again and if you look...
No, but, well, you know, I think what I would say is if you're willing to wait like 7 minutes, I hope that I'm going to derive the renormalization transformation for a simple example, which I think will make clear what's happening here. I hope that'll happen in the next 7 minutes. We'll see. All right, so let's just see, where am I? Okay, so let me work out an example. So I guess you can raise the screen now, thank you. So, as I said, I mean, one of the difficulties was like how to develop a calculational scheme to affect this renormalization in a way that's not incredibly complicated. And it turns out that all ways that involve spin systems do become incredibly complicated. But in percolation, there's a purely geometric way of deriving the normalization group transformation. So let me try and derive it, and you know, let's see what comes out of it. So let's do what's called a real space renormalization. Renormalization. And I'm going to do this for bond percolation. So again, I'm throwing lots of new ideas and phenomenology to you, but I hope it's at least percolation is so simple that it's not such a big deal. So bond percolation is that instead of having coins that are put at the sites of a lattice, I imagine I have toothpicks that I put on the bonds of a square lattice. And then when two toothpicks are meeting, like at a vertex, that means they're connected, and I can look at then the clusters that are formed by these toothpicks. And so here is my renormalization transformation. Here is a 2x2 cell. And if you look at this, so there's like 8 bonds here. If I take this little thing of 8 bonds and put it everywhere on the square lattice, this will tile the entire square lattice. But what I'm going to do is develop a transformation. So here is a probability each bond is present or absent with probability P. And I'm going to do a renormalization transformation, R of P, that's going to renormalize to this. So it rescales by a factor of 2. But the point is that it's not that there's like 8 sites here. I mean, it's not like there's 1. You know, this is like a system of length 2. And this is a system of length 1, but it's got the degrees of freedom are of this full like eight bond thing are going to be somehow renormalized into an effective P prime at this scale. So I'm going to try and develop a criterion for how we calculate P prime as a function of P. And the point is that if I can do this, as we're going to see, I won't be able to finish this today, this transformation P prime as a function of P provides us a way to calculate the critical exponents of percolation. And so doing the same transformation in a magnetic system where you're computing the change in the coupling strength as a function of length scale, one can compute the critical exponents of the magnetic system. And so the point of doing focusing on percolation is that the transformation that I'm going to do here is rather elementary in its concept and its mathematics. And so it's, to my mind, it's the simplest way of introducing the normalization group. So how do I make a criterion? Like, how do I decide, you know, if I have these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, there's 8 bonds, there's 2 to the 8 possible states, because each bond is present with probability P or 1 minus P, so there's 2 to the 8th configurations. And somehow I want to make some criterion that allows me to infer an effective P prime as a function of P. And so the criterion is the following. If there exists a horizontal path across my cell, that of course that contributes to P prime. So let's look at, if I only want to look at horizontal connectivity, then these two bonds, they don't allow to get me across a cell this way. So I can forget about these two bonds. They only have to worry, and this bond also I can forget about. I only have to worry about this, and this, only 5 other bonds. So let me write this down. I mean, let me draw the picture, and I think hopefully it'll be clear that if I want to get across the cell horizontally, only these 5 bonds matter. Because, right? You know, this bond, they don't contribute to going across horizontally. So let's just look at these 5 bonds and ask, like, what are the possible configurations that allow me to get across the system horizontally? So there's this. If all 5 bonds are present.
Sorry, how come if the middle one's vertical, why does that contribute?
Why don't you ask the question in 1 minute if your question still remains? So this configuration happens with probability P to the 5th. There's also this configuration without the bond there, and this happens with probability P to the 4th times 1 minus P. But there's also another set of configurations that look like this. 1, 2, 3, 4 bonds. This guy could be on this side or on that side, or this could have been flipped. There's a total of 5 such configurations consisting of 4 bonds that still will percolate horizontally. So there's plus a term 5P4th 1 minus P. Then let's look at configurations with 3 bonds. So we can have this and that. And this could be flipped upside down. And we could have this. And we can also have, what else can we have? We could have this. Ugh, I'm killing the chalk. We could have this and that. And so there's 2 configurations of this type. There's 2 configurations of this type, because this guy could be, you know, this thing could be on the top or on the bottom. This thing could have been flipped over, so there's 2 of this type. This guy could have been here, and then this could have been flipped, so there's 4 configurations that way. So we're going to get plus 8 P3 1 minus P squared. And then I have plus only 2 bonds. I can have this and this, and it could be on the top or the bottom, plus 2 P squared 1 minus P. So this is my renormalization group transformation. That is the simplest version I know of, like actually to calculate a transformation, a rescaling transformation that relates the occupation probability in the rescaled lattice to the occupation probability in the original lattice. So again, for people who are like more aficionados of the normalization group, they probably say this is all kind of bullshit because it's so trivial. But I would argue that this is actually the right way to maybe try and present it, because you see that at least algebraically, there's nothing to it. The crucial point here is just the concept, which is that under a length rescaling, the effective parameters of your system change in some systematic way. and they change in a systematic way, which is that if you're above the percolation threshold, these parameters will go to like what's called the low temperature or fixed point, or the P equals one fixed point. If you're below the critical point, you know, P will renormalize to zero, which corresponds to the high temperature fixed point in the magnetic system. And at PC or at TC is a fixed point of the transformation. And so what we need to do to calculate critical exponents of percolation is we have to examine this transformation, figure out where is the fixed point of this transformation. And then I'll be done in 1 minute. Look at the fixed point of this transformation. And then, as we'll see, we can then calculate critical exponents. And so in any renormalization group approach, we're doing the same thing. We're trying to compute this P prime as a function of P, looking at behavior near the fixed point and calculate the critical exponents. But I argue that this is the simplest version that I know of how to actually affect this renormalization group approach. So next time I'll work this all out. Okay, so I'm done for now. I just want to mention one other thing, which is that I have office hours Thursday at 1, and it's now on the course website. And so, you know, if you want to come to me enough for office hours, I welcome you. I welcome your questions. I do have a Zoom site also open. I'd rather you come to me in person rather than like doing by Zoom, because what's the point of doing Zoom? That's like, I'm not here. Yeah, so that's it for today.